Welcome to the Morning Star Fellowship Saturday Morning Men's Bible Study Podcast. This week, we're beginning a new series called Faith, Hope, and Freedom. Today's message is...
Second part in this series, Faith, Hope, and Freedom. Today, we're going to talk about nagging issues. And that's not your wife either, just in case you were. There are the big things that consume us, and then there are what I'll call the small drip issues of life. So this week we're going to look at two things, fear and worry, and how they tend to rob us of life. All right, so here's the first principle, and when you get your notes, you're going to find this written down here, but every stimulus in your life creates some sort of a response. All right? So just think about that. Every emotion creates some sort of action. Every emotion that you experience and experience regularly is going to elicit some sort of response. Some responses are attitudes. Some responses are behaviors. So if there are, and we'll describe these in the moment now as negative. Fear is not always a negative, but there are times when fear and worry are very negative emotions. So if you are living in a perpetual state of negative emotion, what do you suppose happens?
You're a negative person.
Yeah. Well, you're a negative person, but what are the responses that you're going to give like? Don't you think? Doesn't that seem to make good sense? So, yet how many of you have ever struggled with worry? So it's certainly a topic we can all relate to. All right, so there's a difference between what we're going to call outright fear and worry. Fear is a response, a bold response to an abrupt intrusion on your life, something that's really powerful. Whereas worry is kind of like that nagging thing. It just, you can't let go of it. Now, how many of you have ever heard advice or read even things that Jesus has said about not worrying? And you try it and it doesn't work. How many of you have ever tried not to worry and that doesn't work? You ever worried about the fact that you worry too much? All right, Brother Jim, we can go to... So we're going to take a look at this. It's on your paper, and you're going to say, well, why are we doing science 101 here? But I think it's really helpful. Because when you can understand the physiology of what happens to you in your mind and the responses that it produces, you have the beginnings of a way to manage what's going on. So here's how this works. If you look at this... exclamation point down here, we're going to say that represents some stimulus, something that causes you to react suddenly. All right, so let's take a look at, have you ever had this experience? Somebody, you're driving down the road 70, 80 miles an hour, somebody either cuts into your lane, cuts in front of you, stops short, and you're pretty sure that there's going to be bad things ahead in the next split second. Has anybody ever had that experience? All right. Now, we're going to assume that you've, because you're all skilled drivers, you've been able to manage your way out of this situation. 5 seconds later, I mean, and I'm talking the real deal. You were pretty sure you could see your future pass before your eyes in that split second. You were thinking if you had the time about the driving record that you would have from this moment on. Do you notice a taste in your mouth, or your heart racing, or any of that? Right. And does it last a while? Does it take like 5 minutes for it to settle down? Yeah. And that's a very real response. So this is what happens. And this is all this, like, we'll call it technical terms. The thalamus, which absorbs all this information, this sensory input, and it decides where it's going to send it all. So it translates the information that's coming from your five senses and decides where in the brain it's going to send it. All right, so this is emergency, crisis moment stuff. So there is this subset of the brain that operates involuntarily. So things that make us breathe, the things that make us hungry, the things that make all this stuff occur. So it sends a message, and ultimately what happens, and it's this low-level subconscious response, it sends this message ultimately to the hypothalamus and starts this process. It heightens your nerves, your nervous sensitivity. Have you ever noticed that immediately after you get scared, your muscles are tense, you're ready to go, you could kill something? The emotional level heightens just like that. And at the same time, it secretes a bunch of hormones into your system. The hormones start to respond and with your heart, and your heart races. You ever notice that? Yeah, you describe that, right? You start to breathe faster. There's all these things that occur without your control. Now that means in the same context, when somebody does something and precipitates an anger response in you, there's a certain sense in which literally you can say you cannot control that. There are certain things that will come into your life that momentarily cause you to respond in a way that is outside of your conscious ability to control. That doesn't mean that when you go home tonight and beat your wife, that was outside your level of control. But I'm not offering you an escape clause here, okay? No, I... Do you have to read too much into this? Do you? So we have no control over that. This is just, don't feel bad about certain things that happen. But there's a second response that occurs simultaneously, and this is the part that we have control over. At the same time as there is information going from the thalamus and directly over to the hypothalamus, there's information going up and being directed toward the experiential part of our brain. What past experiences have we had with this same thing, or what past experiences have we had with a similar thing? And in a split second, your brain starts to pull, like out of the file drawers where it has stored things, all past references to this and whether something was a threat or not. So let's say that every time that you have had this response on the road, that you've been able to navigate your way out of it. In other words, you have a past history of being an excellent driver. So at the same time as there is an involuntary response, there is also a voluntary checking on things that can override that in the long term. It's why I use the 5-second example. 5 seconds after the event, and there's no more danger, but you're experiencing the consequences of what your body does involuntarily. But now let's say that there's a prolonged threat. All right, suppose that you are naturally a worrier and you got your pink slip. And suppose that you have told yourself stories in the past, or you have grown up, maybe you grew up and maybe your dad had periods where he was laid off for long periods of time. Maybe you had to move from place to place. Maybe whenever there was a pink slip in someone's life that was close to you, bad things ended up happening to you. Or maybe there's a friend of yours, maybe you know somebody, you've known multiple people in the past, and they got laid off, and they lost their homes, and then you didn't see Joe anymore because he couldn't live in your neighborhood anymore, because he couldn't afford to live in your neighborhood, and he maybe couldn't live in your town anymore, because he couldn't afford to live in your town. And so over a period of time, we start to tell ourselves stories. Stories about the what might happens of life. How many of you are good at telling yourself stories that aren't true, but could be? So there is a way in which, over a period of time, we condition our minds to respond to certain things. So I want to Return for a moment. If you want to make some notes here, what are some of the things that this involuntary response system does for us? So when these hormones are released into our bloodstream, they regulate our eating habits, our sleeping habits, and even, this is a guy's group, even our sex drive is affected by the hormones that are emitted here. So think about this. Have you ever been worried and lost your appetite? Have you ever been worried and couldn't sleep? These are not strictly voluntary responses. But third question. Those of you who are brute studs in the room here, have you ever been scared, worried over a long period of time, and all of a sudden you aren't so interested in sex anymore?
No.
No, that has not happened. Okay, you have not had that experience either. Okay, for some of us, I think we have. This is a very natural thing. You start to... So what's happening? You know, we said for a moment ago that there were all of these feelings that we experienced immediately after a crisis moment of fear. But what if there was a slow drip of this going into your life all the time? So if fear produces the rush of nervous response, the rush of hormonal response, worry sort of produces the intravenous slow drip version of that. But we said that while the immediate response is involuntary, the long-term response is voluntary. It's learned. We condition ourselves to respond in the way that we do. Think for a moment of any scriptures that can enlighten us about this for a moment. Anything come to mind? Let me throw out something to spring us into some thought here. Do not any longer be conformed, but
be transformed by the renewing of your mind.
To be transformed by the renewing of your mind. What is Paul's assumption there? Yeah. What is Paul's assumption? Exactly. See, there's no need to renew my mind if my mind has got nothing but good stuff in it to begin with. Paul's assumption is that all of us have told ourselves, remember when we talked about the lie a number of weeks back? So all of us have that lie in us. But also, all of us have our own stories that we have told ourselves, our own past experiences. Our own past experiences apart from God. When you think of the word sin, what do you think of? Just immediately, first response. Bad. Okay, anybody else?
Life.
Life? Okay. He said life.
Bondage.
Bondage? I think a lot of people, if you were to go out onto the proverbial street and do this survey thing, I think a lot of people associate sin with behaviors. Other times when you associate sin with behaviors, there's the things that I do, the things that I don't do, the things that I avoid, the things that would make God unhappy. And we tend to think of sin as this collection of behaviors. What if sin is simply a state of being, of existing, and the way we exist? So we're going to take a look at a couple of scriptures now. This is your time to
close.
This is exciting stuff here. There we go. Whoa. All right, so let's start off with 1 John, the fourth chapter.
4th chapter, 27. 1 John 4, the
First John the 4th. It is. But it's tough to do this and do that at the same time, so I asked Jim's help, and Jim has not ever used this operating system before, so does it show up?
It is.
Okay. Alright, so let's take a look at this fourth verse here for a minute. Are we back on track? Sorry, we had a technical glitch, so we got to get back up to speed here. Alright, little children, you are from God and have overcome them. And the them that he's talking about is all of the negative spirits, the evil spirits, the what he refers to as Antichrist elements of this world. And here is the part that maybe you want to underline in your Bible or you want to emphasize in some other way in your notes. He who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. That's a renewing your mind statement. When you look out into the world around you, when you look out at the things that face you in the coming week, when you look out at the bills that you have to pay, the relationships that you have that you need to mend or work on or whatever, the health issues that you are facing, is that your first? Is that my first response? Greater is he who is in me than he who is in the world. Yes, it should be, but is it? What are your past references with that? Remember, when your mind goes to search for the past associations with any given circumstance, suppose that there are five file drawers, metaphorically speaking, filled with bad associations, and only one file drawer filled with greater is he who is in me. What's your response still going to likely be at first? You're going to go to the past experiences. So when I choose to walk outside of God's path, God's light, now we're going to turn over to 1 John the first chapter. Actually, I'll... Yeah, 1 John 1. And I'm going to start to read a while, and it'll show up on the screen in just a moment. We're going to start with the first verse. This is John talking to a group of people. John is now an older man. And he's trying to share with people some things that he may never get another chance to share. In a few moments, we're going to turn over to Christ's last address to his followers. Another one of those last moments, conversations. It's when you typically talk about important things. And so here's what he wants to tell people. He wants them to remember that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes. We have looked upon and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. So he's talking about Jesus. What does he want every one of his readers and listeners to understand? We've seen him, we've touched him, we've talked to him, we have experienced him. We have not made this up. If you're going to renew your mind, what does it take in order to displace the information that's in there now? Bring me that. You got to trust that the information that you're getting, the new information, is from a credible source and is worthy of listening to if it's going to displace the information that's in you. Because the information that's already in you is what we'll call tactile in nature. You have experienced it. You have felt it. You have touched it. You have seen it. And so if you, I'll get right to you then, Bob. If you are going to displace information that's in you, call it null and void and invalid, you're going to have to make sure, you're going to want confidence in the fact that the new thing that you're going to put in you is more credible than the old thing that you want to get out of you.
I was just going to say that when I was a kid, at church, we used to sing, trust and obey. There's no other way to be happy in Jesus than to trust and
And when you're a kid, honestly, for the most part, those are words. And the obedience that is usually referred to, or at least in the childlike mind, is usually, oh, I have to avoid these things, I have to do these things, and it gets back to behavior. All right, so we're going to come back to this text here. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life, the life that was made manifest, and we have seen it and testified to it and proclaim it to you. I'm going to jump down to verse 5. This is the message that we have heard from Him and proclaim to you, that God is light and that in Him is no darkness at all. If we say we have fellowship with Him while we walk in the darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. So if you want to refer to the second page of your notes there and you look at those two converging circles, and what I'd like us to think about for the morning is that sin is simply walking outside God's wisdom. So we can talk about sin being open rebellion against God. Just as often, sin is indifference toward God. Who cares? There may or there may not be a God. And for us, it's sometimes, God, I don't want to necessarily disobey you, but I'd rather just handle this myself my own way. So it's kind of like an aloof independence from God.
Yeah, the Bible says there's a way that seems right unto a man. You just kind of do our own thing your own way, but the end thereof leads to destruction. Yeah, just kind of do our own thing.
I'm going to take us back, Jim, to a textbook couple of verses. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Now, some of you can probably cite them from memory. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your paths straight. How many of you really do that on a regular basis? Now, and keep in mind that what we're talking about is, how much do you worry? How much does worry rob from your life? We're going to back up one step further to where we started. The emotions that I experience on a regular basis are in some way or another going to come out in attitudes and behaviors. That means that the worry that you think you are experiencing personally is in some way or another going to express itself publicly.
In some way it's going to manifest itself as sin.
Yes, I guess we could say that, absolutely.
You say manifest as sin?
As sin.
Yeah, again, I think people can be worried, anxious, and certain things take place, and the response may not look like we're reacting to worry, but it could be anger, because there's fear. And you want to control that situation and stop that. It looks like, at first, well, but that's what that's in there. There's fear in there, and anger is coming out because of fear. I think that's right. As a man, you know, I'm thinking of Scripture, you're saying this, as a man thinks, so is he. So how powerful is that? That'll be the direction we go, what we're thinking.
You can take us back to the 1 John 1 again.
When you ask how many people do that, this may sound odd, but, and of course it's been my life course, but I've had to do that. Whether as a desire or want to trust the Lord, but life, things happen, you find out, I have to do this, or else I'm going to be living like this. So it's better to live like that.
Scott.
I think we all have a lot of trouble in our lives. We all have something that bothers us and worry about it, that we'd like to see improve. I've got my own challenges, everybody has their own challenges.
Sometimes I feel disturbed by that comment. I after being assist the right comment I believe that it's being corrected now. But I sometimes struggle with that as being, I gotta fix it, I gotta resolve it, and she's telling me to pray. And sometimes I have that conflict that, you know, what good is that gonna do? That's not gonna, but it will do a lot. You know, anything, you know, I mean, God says put your worries on me, cast your burdens on me. And sometimes I struggle with doing that openly, and I need a little help from the mind. I think probably all of us fall into that bucket. We don't fall into that bucket, or we need to be vigilant on hey, buddy, why don't we reach out to some higher power for some relief?
And yet, is there a certain sense, and we can be honest here, is there a certain sense in which men can feel inadequate if they need to lean on God? Like a real man would be able to handle this, and apparently I'm not much of a man because I find myself constantly turning to God for help. Maybe once or twice in your life you've experienced that emotion.
But where does that come from? Think about that. That's really that fallen nature. We talk about sin. The fallen nature is a disconnected part of that nature that disconnects us from God, disconnects us from other people, and keeps us trapped in those situations, isolated.
Okay, so Scott, to build on your comment even more, so there's a sense in which as men we can feel a little inadequate if we have to lean on God, if we have to rely on God for guidance. If part of it is our fallen nature, is the other half of it not in some way related to the fact that most of the men that we know, including men in our families, men that we work with and all, who do they rely on? Most of them rely on themselves or wisdom of culture or whatever. And so now we not only feel weak when we look at ourselves and compare ourselves to what we think we should be, but we can sometimes feel weak because we look at the men around us and they don't all of them rely on God. They don't lean on God. And from the outside, it looks like their lives work. It's amazing how many conversations I have with guys about their perception of other men's lives or other families' lives from the outside.
There you go. Based on the outside, because on further investigation...
Yes, on further investigation.
People really leaning on, relying on, trusting in. And then we see all the different things that people go to.
It's a lie that we buy into. It's a lie.
It's a lie that we buy into, but it's a lie.
Yeah. That's what we need to do. That's reason.
Nick.
That's how I live my life basically. I had this conversation a couple weeks ago where, as an example, your face, your outer face, if you want to be working on the course, he's the rock steady, he has all the symptoms and whatnot, nothing bothers him, or deep inside, I live a life right now of constant, I guess, fear, pressure, but without being told to God, but having to be, but I'm going to say this, and after I say it to myself, I'm going to leave myself every day, making my kids to work, get a phone on my way up in the morning, just speak to them, that is a little bit of relief, where deep inside, there's a shield there, that's my breakdown shield every day, when I say that, I'm going to go.
So the men that are relying on themselves, the men that have to make it work for themselves, and maybe you've been that man, maybe from time to time all of us still are that man, what kind of pressure does that bring? Let's just be honest. What kind of pressure does that bring when you have to make your life work? Huh? Doesn't it? Would we call that a stressor in life? And so if that's a stressor, then what does that do to the involuntary responses of our brain? Remember the slow drip thing that we talked about before?
It's more like alert.
It puts you constantly on the edge. Has anybody ever accused you of being uptight? This was not just true confessions about me, okay? There's at least one other man in the room whose hand should have gone up. I don't know who it is. I'm not naming names. I'm just saying that at times we're uptight. And you wonder why you're uptight. And you might even deny it and say, no, I'm not. Or if it's with your wife, it's like, well, if you actually understood the situation and you understood how serious it was, maybe you'd be a little bit more uptight. So it's almost like we're willing to share our uptightness with others so that they can experience the burden that's on us right now. More blank stares. Nobody else gets this but me? Let's turn back to, we're going to go to second chapter of 1 John. I'm just showing you. Okay. Hey, I was...
Come sit with us, Jim, where it's safe.
No. I was trying to show you... I was just showing you an additional feature. So if you want to go to the next chapter, you don't need to search. As long as you're advanced... Yeah, I wasn't taking your job from you. I think it might be NIV, but I'm not sure. I think it is. But that's not what I'm reading from now. All right, so we're going to go to the fourth verse, and that'll scroll sideways then, Jim, if you want to advance it, if you need to. Whoever says, I know him, but does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. Let's just read that again. Whoever says, I know him, but does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will guide your path. What happens when I put these two verses together? Now, what does sin look like? Sin looks like a refusal to allow God to guide my path. Simply to live outside. If you were to look at those two intersecting circles again, how much of your life is overlapped by the knowledge and the direction of God versus how much of it is outside of that? And that changes, I think, from day to day, from decision to decision, choice to choice. When we're pretty sure we want what God doesn't want for us, we step outside that convergence of circles. Beloved, I'm writing a new command to you. This is 7. Not a new command, but an old commandment that you have had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word that you have heard. At the same time, it is a new commandment that I am writing to you, which is true to him in you. Because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. Whoever says that he is in the light and hates his brother is still in darkness. Whoever loves his brother abides in the light and is in him. There is no cause for stumbling. All right, so maybe your challenges are relational challenges. Maybe your heightened sense of whatever is not a fear of the bad that's going to happen to you. Maybe it's an extreme dislike for the people in your life that you have to interact with. And so, in that sense, what's the slow drip and what's causing it? When we're not whole in our relationships, there's something that's agitated about us on the inside. Whenever there's something in our emotions that we're experiencing that's bringing us this agitation, it's sooner or later going to express itself. How many of us are guilty of making the bad relationships in our life worse because they grate at us and they produce poor responses in us? It's like a self-reinforcing cycle. We don't get along with the person. We don't particularly care for the person. Because we don't care for the person, it comes out in our behavior. And what does that do to the relationship? Well, it certainly doesn't improve it, right? In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. going to tell you a short story that I heard this week. I heard it on an interview on a podcast, and it was kind of fascinating. Does the name Sean Johnson mean anything to anybody without looking at the notes?
Say it again.
Sean Johnson? Did you look at your notes? Oh, wow. Oh, you need to put some news stories in your life, dude.
And you were afraid to share, and you bored that thing.
No. He is a she.
And Sean Johnson.
Yeah. Sean Johnson is a girl. Huh? Anyway. So, 2007, Sean Johnson, world champion gymnast, wins the overall gold medal. 2007, it's an off year, unfortunately for her, so it's not an Olympic year. So she gets overall gymnastic gold in an off year. She goes to the Olympics the next year with the U.S. team. She wins gold, I think it's on the balance beam. The team medals silver, so she gets an additional silver medal. From there, she goes on to entertain Scott with Dancing with the Stars, or whatever that is. I have never watched that show, and my life will be okay if I don't see it until the day I die. But apparently it's pretty popular. I did some research on it last night just to check. Could it have been on for 16 seasons? Could it be that long?
So there's two seasons a year.
Well, anyway, she goes on to be the youngest contestant winner of this Dancing on the Stars thing. She won. Okay, so Olympic gold, top-notch athlete. You can see the connection between floor exercise. Actually, it was floor exercises is what she medaled in. So there's a choreography element to that. This is who she is. Athletic, strong, powerful. If you've ever seen a female gymnast, I mean, it's like they got legs like that. They're really strong women. She goes on a skiing trip the next year, and she tears a ligament in her knee. So for a while, they think her Olympic career is done, that her entire athletic career is done. But she undertakes to train and to come back to strength. And she sets a goal that she's going to compete in the next Olympics, the 2012 Olympics. She's able to rebuild her strength and actually has some new elements to some of her performances that have never been done before. She gets them videoed so that she can submit them, and she's ready. She is a likely candidate to make the Olympic gymnastics team for 2012. At the last minute, she backs out because she notices something in her life that she's never experienced before. She says, "There was a time in my life when this was all I lived for, and I was hungry for it, and I had to have this." Pat, I'm sorry, I didn't deliberately save you a donut, but I hope there's some donuts. That's what you told me last night, man. You needed a donut. So, anyway, she decides to step down for this reason. She says, not only don't I want this as much as I should if I'm going to be an Olympic champion, but I could make the team probably and not want it, and there are younger people who are hungry to make this team and may not have the opportunity because there's only so many spots. So she said, in deference to the kids who might not ever have a shot at it, I'm going to step down. And so after that, she's interviewed, and the interviewer asks this question. Was there anything really difficult about coming back? I mean, you've been training all of your life. You've been an athlete all of your life. Says, it looks like you recovered completely. As a matter of fact, this guy got to watch some of the videos of some of the maneuvers that she did. And you're amazing. And she says, I was in water that I had never been in before. It was the first time in my life that I was scared. Up until this point in time, she said, everything that I did had a predictable nature to it. If I trained harder, I got the results that I wanted. If I exercised more, I built the additional strength that I needed. Everything in my life, there was a direct cause and effect. And even if it was difficult, even if I had a limited amount of sleep and I had to work hours on end, I knew that I could rise to the top. She says, this was the first time in my life when I did something and it didn't work. My body didn't respond the way I expected it to. Nothing happened the way I expected it to. And I was afraid that the rest of my life was ruined. So she said, it was the most difficult thing that I did in my life. Now, she's 18, 19 at that time. What were all the stories that were in her? Think about it. She started, and incidentally, there's another piece of filler that I should have given you. Her parents got her into gymnastics by the age of 4. And everything that I have done has always worked. I have excelled at everything that I have done. So imagine that you get to be world class at the top of your game and you have never had any significant failure, any significant struggle. How great is the fear in your life when everything that has taken you to be a world class person now fails you? I said it was the greatest learning experience of my life. So I want to wrap up here pretty soon so that we have a chance to have some good discussion. I want to do one final thing. Jim, if you want to turn over to John 16. The real John, not 1 John. So we're going to start at the first verse. Again, Jesus talking. He has just described a whole collection of things that are going to happen. Some things that are going to happen to him. Some things that his followers are going to experience. The way the people in the world are going to respond, or at least the people in Jerusalem at that time. And so here's how he starts to wrap this up. I've said all these things to you to keep you from falling away. They will put you out of the synagogues. Indeed, the hour is coming when whoever kills you will think he is offering service to God. And they will do these things because they have not known the Father nor me. So think about what he's saying. He's saying that the people who say they serve God are actually going to kill you or desire to kill you because you're trying to serve God. But I have told you these things so that when their hour comes, you may remember that I have told them to you. Now we're going to jump down to verse 7. Nevertheless, I tell you the truth. It is to your advantage that I go away. For if I do not go away, the Helper will not come to you. But if I go away, I will send him to you. Now the first part of this narrative right here, this story that he's telling, is not applicable directly to us. Some of the bad things that were going to happen to his followers are not guaranteed to happen to us. The experiences they had are not guaranteed to be our experiences. But this next promise is pretty much universal. You and I can claim this part of the promise. But if I go away, I will send him to you, and when he comes, and this is the important part here, he will convict the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. Concerning sin, and notice this is not a behavioral issue at all, because they do not believe in me. Somebody restate that. In Jesus' mind, what is the chief sin?
Unbelief.
Not having a confidence in God. So we offend God the most when by the way we choose to manage our lives, we say, I would rather trust me, God, than trust you. Now for those of you who have been fathers, and you've experienced this firsthand, when your kids would rather trust their own wisdom, given their short life experience, than trust you, and let's be honest, after the anger has subsided, which may be the first response, probably is the first response. On the inside, how does that make you feel when your kids would rather trust their own limited wisdom than yours? Does it damage the relationship, at least in some small way, at least momentarily? Huh?
A little tear.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, and I think this is at the heart of God. When you and I choose to trust ourselves, it's sin of the order of relationship tear. Just like you said. All right, concerning judgment, because I'm sorry, I've got to back up here. Concerning judgment, but I will go and send you. And when he comes, he will convict the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. Concerning sin, because they did not believe in me. Concerning righteousness, because I go to the Father and you will see me no longer. Concerning judgment. Now, before we read this, given that he's just talked about sin, what would be the words that you would think that he would use regarding judgment? Who would be judged? Huh? Exactly. But that's not what he says at all here. Because the ruler of this world is judged. And so what's he saying? This world system no longer has power over us. It is defeated. And we can either choose, through the stories that we tell ourselves, the renewing of our mind, to live above that, and live at a different plane and choose different responses, or we can choose to live in the stories that we have previously told ourselves and the worry and the negativity, which will ultimately express itself in one way or another in every relationship and every situation in our lives. Okay, so we're doing the study wrap-up here. Bob and I are going to hash out a couple of the main ideas that we talked about for the morning. So, Bob, what was some of your takeaway?
Well, at our table, the discussion was mainly around fear and mainly around the boss. It was much more work than it was, you know, our wives or our kids or, you know, road rage or anything like that. It was really all about I got a worker who reports to me that I just avoid, or I've got a boss who has it out for me and things like that.
Okay, and so was it worry? Was it other negative emotions? What would you say was the big negative emotion that you guys were grappling with?
Yeah, the two that I heard was definitely worry. When you wake up in the morning, a general sense of dread, or even worse, when you're driving to work. One guy said, well, you know, right before I go into a meeting that I'm particularly dreading, you know, I pray for wisdom, or I pray to keep my mouth shut. The other thing was that the fear was the fear of losing a job.
Okay.
And one guy said, you know, I realized about 3 years ago that I worry about losing my job so much and I keep doing it, that I'm not going to worry about it, because if I do, I do. And then hopefully the Lord directs me where my next opportunity is.
Okay, so was there any general consensus about how long a person worries before they finally realize what they're doing and redirect?
Well, we talked about prayer a lot, but there was no specific timeline involved.
Okay. I mean, I'm thinking you described the fellow that might, or a couple of people that maybe are driving to work and they're dreading what they're going to face there.
Right.
So if you have a 30-minute commute, let's say, that's the potential for 30 minutes of worry to build up that heightened sense of dread before you ever walk in the door. And what would you do to combat that?
Well, yeah, he did talk about what he does to combat it, which is exactly what I do, and that is to pray the entire way to work.
Okay.
You know, and try to center yourself on the realities versus the perceived realities. Zig Ziglar used to say that fear is false evidence appearing real.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. So I guess what you're saying, what your group decided, is that there's the proactive method of prayer, but maybe just as important, reminding yourself of the truth that you know from God's Word that you've taken in. So if you're grounding yourself in some good, solid truth from God's Word, and then you can maybe even pray that out in your own life as
right.
you're driving to work.
Right, yeah, that's well, good. You know, and the John 16 verses mm-hmm. seem to hit home a lot. And the guys at my table really liked the 13th verse, where You know, the whole, it says the Holy Spirit will help you. He'll plumb the depths of God and then tell you what God said, and you need not fear the future.
Right. But I'll bet it takes some practice to hear that small voice of God, if you want to call it that. I think that that's probably, at first, if you're new to this whole experience, that is probably the quietest voice among all the others that are shouting into your head.
And I have to admit that it probably took me the better part of 40 years. you know, but once you do hear it,
yeah,
you crave it.
Yeah.
And once you do hear it and you learn to respect it, because sometimes you can hear it and disregard it,
mm-hmm.
and then there's real blowback.
Whereas
once you hear it and respect it, it does take a lot of pressure off your back.
Yeah.
Mostly I hear, be quiet.
Yeah, I know one of the things that we talked about was the way men will manage the stressors in their lives when they don't lean on God. Like, we'll pretend that we don't need God. But one of the ways that we looked at it, and a couple of the guys said almost exactly the same thing, well, we'll just live in denial. We'll bury the issue. We won't mm-hmm. deal with the issue. That, believe it or not, I think that believers can be courageous because they have God on their corner. And when you don't have that confidence, you almost try to ignore or pretend that the bad stuff isn't there. It's like pull the blanket over your head and pretend that the monsters under the bed aren't there, as opposed to the believer who can say, okay, I know this is a bad situation. I know I may lose my job. I know financially we're in trouble. But because I have God on my side, I can walk through this with some courage, and I can have the courage to respond to the situation instead of try to hide from it.
Right.
So, I think this is...
Yeah, I do have one final thought.
Go ahead, Bob.
That was one of the guys at our table said that he had always been taught, as he grew up, that he should control what he can control and let the other stuff go. And two of us both felt that control is an illusion, and that... in essence, there's really almost nothing that we can control other than the choices that we make.
Yeah.
You know, fear is a choice. Anger is a choice. Being offended is a choice. And so is being grateful.
Okay. Well, this has been good. So, guys, thanks for joining us this week in our podcast, and look forward to catching up with you again next week. So for Bob and myself, have a great week. Allow God to guide and direct your steps and follow in His path throughout the week. See you next week.